This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. There was the most recent prominent police murder of 13-year-old Andy Lopez in California. There is the growing rate of incarceration and caging of millions of people in U.S. prisons. There is still stop and frisk and other racial profiling policies.
And thus there is the imperative to confront these policies and dismantle the practices of the discriminatory and cruel criminal justice system. So now we present highlights from two events sponsored by the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and Communities United for Police Reform to stop, stop and frisk, and to stop mass incarceration.
We begin with the great Afro-Latin jazz pianist Arturo O'Farrell's on the struggle against injustice. And then we'll hear from Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, one of the leading hip-hop generation intellectuals in the country, host of the nationally syndicated TV show Our World with Black Enterprise, and author of The Classroom and the Cell, Conversations on Black Life in America with Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Next we'll hear from Jibril Touré of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, who was also a plaintiff in the police profiling case of Daniels versus the City of New York.
We'll wind up with a reading of letters from brothers held at the notorious Pelican Bay Prison, some further thoughts of Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, and again, jazz great Arturo O'Farrell. But now we start with the comments of jazz great Arturo O'Farrell.
Thank you. We can reimagine this thing. Stop and frisk is happening because there's an argument that crime is going up. But every single thing that the government has done has taken resources out of the community that makes crime go up. We know what works, right? I mean, you get rid of after-school programs, you get rid of art programs, you get rid of music programs, you defund public education, you get rid of mental health resources, you get rid of rehab, you get rid of all this stuff, and you get crime. Part of how they've managed to do that is that they've convinced us that the government needs to be smaller and that the public is bad. And the way they tell you the public is bad is by making you think that the public means y'all. So that whenever something is public, it's black and it's brown and it's poor. So it's public school, black. Public education, black. Public housing, black. Public transportation, black. Even the white folk use all that stuff more than we do. And so at the moment when the public itself, including us, think that we don't need this stuff because it's us, they were then able to defund it and render the people that need it disposable. And it's this vision of disposability is what makes all this happen. They don't mind getting a 1% hit rate on stop and frisk because the 99% of people they think they're inconveniencing are disposable. They don't mind wrongfully using a weapon, whether it's on a BART train in Oakland or whether it's right here with Sean Bell, because the people who die in their minds are disposable. We have to convince them. No, first we got to convince us. Yeah. But ultimately, we have to convince them that we are not disposable, that our voices are not disposable, that our bodies are not disposable to move the ball forward. We're going to bring up, we got Jabril Touré. Jabril, I want to ask you about resistance to this, because we don't ever want to tell a story that just has us succumbing to this. There's been resistance. MXGM in particular has been a model of that kind of resistance. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. I was original plaintiff in the Daniels versus NYPD lawsuit. So I've had a lot of... Thank you. I mean, you know, I don't deserve any extra accolades for that, but I have had a lot of experience dealing with the city and how they attempt to cover up and attempt to shift forms in their policy. I guess I will start by saying the name of Richie Perez, because he's the reason why we're all here. Just so folks are aware of historically how it happened, Daniels was filed in the late 90s as a result of all the work from all these organizations. It was actually a class lawsuit with 10 named plaintiffs, and everything else was class action. The result of that lawsuit was that the city was ordered to make certain changes. The city was ordered to enact a new racial profiling policy. It was actually ordered to turn over the data on stop and frisk, which is why CCR began receiving that data in the early 2000s. Basically, there was a process of a few years where we started to look at the data and see that it was not only getting worse, but it was getting way, way worse. And so it's to the point where it was like the last year that was measured in stop and frisk was actually 700,000 stops, where in the initial data that was turned over 10 years earlier, it was only 100,000 stops. So clearly, even though there had been a lawsuit, they hadn't done the work to make the change. That's why it was necessary to file Floyd again. Healthy skepticism, that's the approach that we need to take as a community. It's important for us to realize that it is not about what Bill de Blasio does. Bill de Blasio is a mayor. He will act as every mayor does. This is a struggle that actually began long before I was involved, long before anybody in this room. It's not just about stop and frisk. The issue really goes to abusive policing in general and ultimately racism, unequal application of laws. And this is something that has become really, I would say, the number one issue in this country. When you look at the cases of Natasha McBride, the case in Detroit, the Trayvon Martin case, when you look at what happened to Ramali Graham as a result of stop and frisk, he lost his life. It wasn't just a matter of being intimidated or having trauma. He actually lost his life, and we're still fighting for those families. So I want to make a point of calling out Natasha from Flatbush, who's in the back, if you could just raise your hand. She is a family member of Chantel Davis. And a lot of people over these years have lost their life to the NYPD. We've had a number of cases where people have in dubious situations due to stop and frisk. You know, one thing leads to another and someone loses their life. The reason why her group in particular is commendable is because they've taken up the mantle of leadership in their neighborhood. They actually had a Hoops for Justice tournament this past summer in Flatbush that was amazing. First of all, the kids were like the best basketball players I've ever seen. We were able to come out on that court and do a Know Your Rights workshop at halftime of those games. And that's where things have to go. We have to take this issue on as a community where we're dealing with ourselves. Not that we shouldn't be holding all those people accountable. The inspector general that's going to be put in, whoever that is, we're going to have to hold them accountable. The mayor's office, we're going to have to hold them accountable. Anyone else in elected office will be held accountable. But the reality is we have to hold each other accountable, right? When we see something wrong go down on the block, we have to hold each other accountable. We can't just look at our leaders and point to that person and this person. We need to know that we have some kind of response that's going to end up protecting our community. To that end, we've been doing Cop Watch for over 10 years. Cop Watch is a volunteer-led program where we basically train people on how to use video cameras, how to observe police activity without escalating, without obstructing and getting yourself arrested. We teach people how to safely buy a video camera, to work in teams, to protect the rights of innocent young people who are being stopped in the streets. If we had enough time tonight, we could probably show you video after video of how cops back down, how they get back in their vehicles, how they say, hey, make sure you get my good side, and all that kind of stuff when we show up with a camera. All the things they don't do when we turn our head and we don't do anything. To me, the answer is for every person that's in this room to make that pledge that when they see someone being brutalized, someone being stopped, someone being violated in any way, that you do whatever you can. If you can only pull out your cell phone and stand at a respectable distance so you don't get arrested, do that, because the solutions are going to come from us. The reality is we have won some major victories in the last few months, and the reality also is that there's a system in place to make sure that those victories are held up. And that's what the Second Circuit of Appeals is doing. They removed the judge. They're putting delays on the reforms, you know, the process of dialogue that was about to start. We can't expect the system to do anything other than what it's going to do. It's protecting its economic resources. We all know about the prison industrial complex and how much of this is related to economics, the funding of the courts and the funding of every other law enforcement program. So we can't expect capitalism to work against itself. We can't expect police department that's funded out of targeting certain neighborhoods and certain communities to work against itself. We have to do that. Well, let me also mention, Kyam Livingston was a young mother who was arrested. She was held in central booking and begged these officers for 8 hours to come and take a look at her because she was having severe stomach pains. She begged and begged for them to come and give her some medical assistance. Other people who were actually in the cell ended up being her caretakers. These people who the system tries to refer to as criminals ended up being her caretakers, also begging for these officers to come and do something. They did nothing. They told her to shut up, to keep it down, and she eventually lost her life. This happened in early September. For those of you who want to get involved in this movement, and we're basically demanding videotape the central booking, and we also want the names of the officers. If we can't support a family that has lost their children to police negligence, then it's not much to talk about, honestly. There's a petition outside to sign, and we'll be meeting with Hakeem Jeffries, we'll be meeting with Ken Thompson and all those folks to try to get justice for this family. But keep in mind that even though stop and frisk and things like that may be changing, the system finds a way to change its spots. It changes form. And so we can't think that the racism, that the brutality, and that even the loss of life is going to go away immediately. And we have to stay vigilant and stay prepared. Thank you.
Mark Lamont Hill, the last time that I saw you was during the anniversary commemoration of the Attica Rebellion. You were fielding a telephone call from Mumia Abu-Jamal. There was a kind of exhilaration in the audience that night, and I wonder if you can give me some of your thoughts on what you heard or saw or thought about what occurred this evening as people spoke, certainly in response to the unconstitutionality of stop and frisk, but questions of restorative justice, questions of, again, the really purpose and the significance of the enormous exponential character and policy and practice of stop and frisk in communities of color in this city.
we have to have a different conversation, not a conversation about how can we get the police to abuse us less, not how can we have a conversation about overburdening prisons with black and brown bodies from urban spaces through the stop and frisk and other racial profiling practices, but it's really how can we have a different conversation about what justice looks like. To me, a real conversation about justice doesn't equate justice with punishment, doesn't equate punishment with confinement and containment, which means that we don't need a stop and frisk policy. We don't need a jail full of arrests to convince ourselves that we're being safer. We need to actually reimagine what safety looks like. We need to reimagine what peace looks like, what justice looks like. Until we have that conversation, stop and frisk becomes almost a red herring. We end up chasing that as opposed to dealing with these core fundamental issues, which simply are, in a late capitalist state, we are going to have people being criminalized because we need a criminal class in order to have an exploited class in order to continue to feed this beast known as capitalism. That's the conversation that needs to be had here. That said, I do appreciate the very urgent and pragmatic concerns that people have. At an event like this, people want to know that their kids are going to go out and come back home in one piece, that they're not going to pick their kids up from a police station for something they didn't do, that their kids aren't going to be arrested or beaten or tortured by police because they had the audacity to ask why they were being stopped and frisked when they did nothing wrong. There's a very real urgency attached to the concerns that people express today, and I don't want to dismiss those or reduce them to false consciousness, but I do think there is a more fundamental materialist analysis we can be engaged in. For me, it's both and. I think we have to deal with the immediate pressures of legislation. We have to deal with the immediate concerns of law enforcement and of communities, but we have to imagine and dream something a little bit bigger.
Why the evolution of stop and frisk? Why has it become so dominant and predominant, and why the growth of the mass incarceration process in the prison industrial complex? The question of the threshold as to the evolution, which certainly I don't see as just inadvertent or a matter one way or the other of community or non-community policing. And I'm wondering about your own thoughts, given your experiences and your writing and perhaps your conversations with Mumia.
Mumia and I have definitely talked about this. I mean, I think, again, over the last 30 and 40 years, we haven't just seen mass incarceration. We haven't just seen a growth in prison, but we've seen a growth in criminalization. We have developed a national culture that equates justice with incarceration, that equates peace with arrests. We've convinced ourselves that we can arrest ourselves out of the social misery that's produced from poverty, that's produced from drug abuse, that's produced from mental illness, et cetera. And so two things have happened over the last 30 or 40 years. One, we have widened the net of criminality. Mm-hmm. We've literally come up with more things that you can get in trouble for. Because arrests are going up, crime actually isn't going up in the most literal sense. When people aren't committing more violent acts than before, they're not committing more atrocious acts than they were 50 years
ago. Correlation with the role of African Americans in particular in the workforce, or the lack thereof,
exactly,
as the
right
case may be?
That's exactly right. And so the only sort of space for public, for governmental intervention, public housing, public education, et cetera, is through mass incarceration. That's actually the only kind of public space that the government is sort of dutifully invested in. And so what we've seen is the expansion of the net of criminality. We've widened the net so that there's more stuff that people get incarcerated for, but it's become common sense that people deserve to be incarcerated for that stuff. So, for example, we've convinced ourselves that the woman who's in East New York smoking crack is not only someone who has a medical addiction, but she's also a bad person. She's also a criminal. We don't have that same construct in our mind of the white-collar, white male executive in a corporation who's snorting coke. We consider him someone who might be technically violating the law but not harming anybody. And as a result, we don't really want him in prison. We might want him in rehab. We might want him to stop. We might not care. We might think it's boys being boys, but we don't want him in prison. Whereas the crack addict somewhere else in East New York, as a black woman or black male or as a poor person of any race, we're thinking of them as part of a criminal class that deserves to be incarcerated. And so essentially we're finding kids with joints and we're arresting them. And we somehow have convinced ourselves that that's quality law enforcement because our arrest numbers go up, because we're able to produce statistics that make a different public feel safer because they were committing arrests. So it's a deeply problematic thing here. So we've widened the net of criminality by deciding that more people deserve to be in prison and that more things deserve to be incarcerable offenses. And then we've deepened the net of criminality. We've made the penalties so much greater than they've ever been before, whether it's walking into a school with scissors and being kicked out, or whether it's these vicious drug policies, whether it's the taking away judicial flexibility from judges. All these things have deepened the net. We've made the penalties greater and deeper. So if those two things happen at the same time over 30 or 40 years, you don't just have a lot of people in prison, but you have a culture of common sense saying that this is where people belong and this is how we solve our problems. And so when more problems come, There is a rash of TVs being stolen out of someone's house. There is a riot. There is mass unemployment. Our solutions become instinctively punitive. They become instinctively driven by a kind of impulse to incarcerate. And that's the danger. That's why you see that over the last 30 or 40 years.
What have you got on your... Any more books?
Plenty of books coming out. Me and Mumia have another book coming out. Very
soon. Aha!
Yes. We're putting together a project called Still Here, The Black Left in the Age of Obama. And we're essentially talking about the way in which...
Is Glenn Ford part of that book?
Glenn Ford has to be part of this book, you know. And a bunch of other really brilliant minds who, quite honestly, are still here, despite the fact that so many mainstream, ostensibly left-wing voices have wilted in the age of Obama. They've become moderates, or they always were, and now they're coming out of their moderate closets. There are a bunch of folk who still are advocating for a true left-wing, a progressive, a radical, even revolutionary agenda. We want to spotlight those voices. We want to spotlight those issues. I'm also doing a project called The Barbershop Notebooks, which is a collection of pieces that look at culture, politics, and education through the lens of a radical politics. And so a lot of good stuff coming up, a lot of work coming up. And most importantly, we're on the ground fighting for everything, not the least of which is the freedom of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We're going to continue to fight until Mumia's home.
Mark Lamont Hill, thank you for your contributions, and we're looking forward to the next book.
My pleasure. Peace.
What they tell you you're going to do is what the opposite. Here is that on the bottom line.
little bit of Stop and Frisk Blues by Arturo O'Farrell. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, and go to our website, www.buildingbridgesradio.org.